Hey, guys. Back at the playground again, huh?
Yep. You know what this playground could use? A wine country.
Heck yeah. And some waves. So we could go surfing.
Oh, yeah. Ah, love that.
A redwood forest would be cool.
I'm in.
Ah, ski slopes.
Let's do it.
Can a girl go shopping?
Yeah, baby.
Wait. Did we just invent California?
Discover why California is the ultimate playground at visitcalifornia.com.
Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
If you're 21 years old and use nicotine or tobacco, I'm here to tell you about Black Buffalo and how it's redefining tradition for millions of adult consumers. So if you're over 21, consume nicotine or tobacco, and want to join the Black Buffalo herd, head over to blackbuffalo.com to learn more. Warning. This product contains nicotine. Nicotine is an addictive chemical. Black Buffalo products are intended for adults aged 21 and older who are consumers of nicotine or tobacco.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. This is Robert, and this is going to be a vault episode for you. This is one that we originally published 9/22/2020. I believe this was for Hobbit Day. This is a discussion of the orcs of Middle Earth, getting into where they come from in the dark corners of the human imagination. So I hope you enjoy.
But of those unhappy ones who were ensnared by Melkor, little is known of a certainty. For who of the living has descended into the pits of Utumno, or has explored the darkness of the councils of Melkor? Yet this is held true by the wise of Eressia, that all those of the Kendi who came into the hands of Melkor, ere Utumno was broken, were put there in prison, and by slow arts of cruelty were corrupted and enslaved. And thus did Melkor breed the hideous race of the orcs, in envy and mockery of the elves, of whom they were afterwards the bitterest foes. For the orcs had life, and multiplied after the manner of the children of Ilúvatar, and naught that had life of its own, nor the semblance of life, could ever Melkor make since his rebellion in the Ainulundili before the beginning, so say the wise. And deep in their dark hearts the orcs loathed the master whom they served in fear, the maker only of their misery.
Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind, a production of iHeartRadio.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Joe McCormick. And man, I had to read that opening part quite a few times. That, of course, is from The Silmarillion by J.R.R. Tolkien.
Yeah, and of course, we're talking about Tolkien because today's publication date is September the 22nd, which also happens to be the credited birth date of both Frodo and Bilbo Baggins, the hobbits central to J.R.R. Tolkien's saga of Middle-earth. Thus, this has become known as Hobbit Day, which falls during Tolkien Week, at least as proposed by the American Tolkien Society in 1978. So this tradition is roughly a month older than I am.
That's funny. So it's a week-long festival then?
Yeah, apparently a week-long celebration of Middle Earth and all things Tolkien. I was not aware of it until just last month, and I realized the publication day lined up perfectly. And I'm like, oh, well, we've already done an episode on The One Ring. We did another one on hobbits and how their biology works and how they relate to multiple meals per day and to sunlight. And so I thought, well, we got to come up with something else that we can talk about on Hobbit Day itself.
So you wanted to talk about orcs. I guess you've had Tolkien on the brain all year, right? Are you still reading it with the family?
No way. I haven't been reading it. We've been meaning to come back around to Fellowship of the Rings, but instead we just got into Star Wars this year. So that's where we are. But I couldn't let the stars seem to align on this particular episode. So I thought, well, we got to do something. And I started looking around. And I thought, well, maybe it's orcs. Orcs are such a central part of the work and something that has been highly influential on fantasy in general. Like, generally speaking, fantasy games, fantasy books, fantasy movies, they're just lousy with orcs.
You know, I was trying to think when I first became aware of orcs. And I think before I ever read any Tolkien, I played the Warcraft games.
Oh, yeah.
which have orcs in them, which are essentially the palace guards at Jabba's palace from Return of the Jedi.
Yeah. You know,
like they're green and they've got tusks and they've got kind of like bulldog faces.
Yeah, they have that. They look a lot like those Gamorrean guards from Jedi. They also, of course, that whole gaming system, I think, has its roots, too, in being inspired by the Warhammer games as well.
Oh, really?
Which I'll touch base on that in a little bit, because I think they're very important to the history of how we interpret orcs. I think I have always pictured the orcs of Middle Earth in less detail, like, you know, more abstract, brutish creatures in the rough semblance of human beings. And part of that might be that I, at a very early age, I saw at least parts of the original, 1978 animated version, where all the animation is pretty much like that. It's kind of like abstract shapes and less detail, and the orcs and other evil things are often shown in kind of a silhouette.
This is the Ralph Bakshi one with the, does it have rotoscoping in it, rotoscoping animation?
I believe that's the technique they used. Yeah, it was, it's interesting. It's a little bit different from the Rankin Bass animation that you saw on The Hobbit and then saw on The Return of the King, which basically finished what this film didn't.
Oh, this is the one where Saruman is Santa Claus. They give him a red robe.
It's been so long. I don't even remember that, honestly. But I remember flashes of it. It had some sort of an impact on me. I'd say that I think in hearing about Middle Earth and all, it probably also has a lot to do with like the two earliest stories that I remember my dad telling me were he would tell me about Beowulf and Grendel. So I have this like really early idea of Grendel in my head. And then I remember him telling me about the Battle of Hastings. So I think I ended up sort of cobbling together this Middle Earth orc as being a combination of Norseman or Viking and that figure of Grendel.
Hmm.
But that's just me personally, just based on like where I came into learning about The Hobbit and what I've been exposed to previously. And as we're going to discuss here, there's subsequently been so many different visions of orcs and what orcs are. And we're still in the process of defining and redefining what an orc is.
For some reason, I remember thinking that the orcs of the Peter Jackson movies have a very Dickensian villain kind of flair. Like they've got this, sinister Cockney accent that you hear.
Yeah, the Peter Jackson orcs are very important in our modern perceptions of them. But even those are suitably varied. There are a lot of different visions of what an orc is in those films. They range from like big, like dark brutes to more goblin-y forms. There's like one general that shows up in, I think, Return of the King that has this very like elephant man, tumorous appearance. And then by the Hobbit films, they seem to have refined it a little bit to where you have either refined the orc in general or just they've decided to portray these sort of Misty Mountain orcs as being almost kind of Nosferatu-in. Like they kind of look like big, beefy Nosferatus in a way that I think really works.
More the classic Max Schreck Nosferatu or the Klaus Kinski Nosferatu?
The Max shredded Nosferatu. That's what they are. Like, just very beefy.
Yeah.
Juice to
Muscle
the Max.
Muscle Max. Yeah. Nice.
Now, we mentioned Warhammer just a second ago. I've long been a fan of Warhammer and Warhammer 40,000. One is like the fantasy version. One is essentially like a sci-fi version of the same universe, and it has evolved since then. And you have orcs in both of them. And in both games, orcs are depicted as green-skinned, almost bulldog-like in their cranial structure. And even more to the point, though, these orcs are presented in a manner that I would dare describe as fun. If orcs are often, you know, serving to represent a kind of dark savagery of humanity, I'd say that the orc boys, as they're sometimes called, that's with a Z, run counter to that, embodying this spirit that kind of celebrates a kind of goofy primal rebellion, especially in Warhammer 40,000, the futuristic version, which is a very dark and nihilistic, you know, grimdark kind of fictional setting. The orcs are pretty much the only faction that actually resonate with any lightness and whimsy. Like you see depictions of them or the way that various collectors have painted them up, and they often have bright colors and kind of a fun, goofy quality to them. I ran across one, I think this is like a current figure, where it's like an orc captain and he has like a big pirate hat on and a bunch of cool, colorful iconography. They have this kind of a slapdash technology to them.
They're a little bit Monstars in Space Jam. Do you remember that?
I haven't seen Space Jam, but
it's when the nerdy aliens get really big and good at sports, and then they become the Monstars.
Okay, well, I'll take your word for it. I guess I'm imagining from your telling of it, like sort of lighthearted monstrosity, kind of cartoonish monstrosity.
Yes.
Okay.
Space Jam never gets too bleak, you know. Space Jam doesn't go full grimdark.
A grimdark Space Jam reboot, that would be something.
God, that'd be so good.
Now, this embracing of orc nature, you'll find this elsewhere as well. In Dungeons & Dragons, of course, one may play a half-orc or even full-blooded orcs, which allows room for that sort of thing. We'll come back to Dungeons & Dragons in a bit. But one title, and this is one that our former co-host Christian turned me on to, there's a comic artist by the name of James Stokoe, I believe. That's S-T-O-K-O-E. And he has this comic series called Orcstain. And it presents a delightfully crude and whimsical vision of a world just overrun with orcs. The protagonist himself is an orc warrior. And it has this kind of, I would say, you know, the art that accompanies the British musical act Gorillaz. It has Gorillaz Tank Girl kind of vibe to it. It has this very kind of punk rock aesthetic, which I've seen that with orcs elsewhere, where this is kind of convergence of like punk art culture and the embracing of the orc.
Yeah, punk monsters, I think, is actually a pretty good tradition. I don't know how it got started, but I think of in the old Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles comics, like the Bebop and Rocksteady, are very much like punk monsters.
Exactly. Yeah, good point. So what does all this mean? What are orcs, and why do they resonate with us? So why do we continue to tell stories about orcs and involve orcs in our games and our fiction, et cetera? Can we discuss science in relation to orcs? And are there problematic aspects here as well? So that's what we're going to be talking about in this episode. But the first step, I imagine, is to discuss what Tolkien says in-universe about the creation of the orcs, coming back to our cold opening, and then also discuss where he even got the name orc itself.
All right, well, let's enlist in the orc army.
All right. Okay, so in Tolkien's writings, the orcs are the most common evil foot soldier. They're like the ubiquitous enemy. In The Hobbit, we deal more with goblins, which are often understood to be either lesser orcs or a particular species or subspecies of mountain orc. And Tolkien apparently rolled out a few different contradictory origin stories for the orc in his work. But according to the Tolkien Encyclopedia, which is a book I typically turn to for such matters, they were twisted forms of life that Melkor spawned in the pits of Utumno. They served as the bulk of his armies, and then after his defeat, they served as the bulk of Sauron's armies as well.
Now, was Melkor the same person as Sauron in an earlier incarnation, or was Melkor the god that Sauron served?
My understanding, and this is a good point for us to point out, that neither of us are Tolkien scholars or profess to be Tolkien experts.
Robert, you keep wanting to do these Tolkien episodes, and then we get the mail from people who are like, actually...
I know, and I love it. I invite it. I definitely want to hear from people more knowledgeable in Tolkien scholarship than I am, or just in general, orc scholarship, if you will. My understanding is that Melkor was the original fallen god. Mm-hmm. that rebelled against everything. Then he was defeated. Sauron, being like a fallen Hephaestus-type forge god, mm-hmm. had served Melkor, but with Melkor destroyed or, taken out of the picture permanently, now it's time for Sauron to shine. Basically, Sauron was Melkor's VP.
Okay, cool.
Now we kicked off the episode here with that cold reading about the creation of the orcs in the pits of Autumno, the idea that they would have been created in this sort of blasphemous process that takes place in a fallen god's dungeons.
Like it was a sort of a mockery of life.
Yeah, the idea that they captured elves and twisted them through torture into this new terrible form of life, and that the orcs therefore were products of pain and hate. They lived only for pain and hate, and outwardly they were, quote, and this is from the Tolkien Encyclopedia, bent, bow-legged, and squat. So they were ape-like in many respects, but cunning and cruel. Their skin looked as if burned, and their eyes were, quote, crimson gashes like narrow slits in black iron grates behind which hot coals burn. Now, there are different varieties of orc, we're told, in Middle-earth, from the goblins of the Misty Mountains to standard orcs, and then later you get these taller, more sun-resistant Uruk-hai orcs that were made by Sauron much later. And it sounds as if the idea is that Sauron ends up combining orc stock with human stock to create a more human-statured, day-tolerant trooper.
Yeah, and I think that ties into the idea that a lot of creatures in Middle-earth or in Tolkien's world, like if you're a bad creature, you're often sort of confined to a nighttime existence. You can't go out in the sun. Trolls are this way, and the Hobbit trolls are turned to stone when Gandalf tricks them into staying up till the sun comes out. And I guess the idea is also that maybe the orcs or the goblins just don't really like sunlight.
Yeah. Now, the Tolkien Encyclopedia and other sources as well, it has you'll find lengthy passages discussing the role of orcs to the history of Middle-earth. There's no shortage of information there. But basically, the idea is that throughout their history, the numbers swell and shrink at times when Dark Lords rise up and then fall away. When Dark Lords come back to power, the orcs are there to fill the ranks of the evil armies. But even when they're defeated, they never completely go away. They kind of shrink to the hidden corners of Middle-earth. And even with the defeat of Sauron and Middle-earth's transformation into a modern world, there's this idea that the orcs are out there somewhere. So that's the in-universe explanation, or as canon and origin stories can be cobbled together. But of course, we know that J.R.R. Tolkien did not create Middle-earth out of nothing. He forged it out of existing mythological, folkloric, and historic motifs.
And I would say, actually, maybe more than anything, out of linguistic motifs.
Yes.
That Tolkien loved language, and you often get the sense that his story came out of having a word for something.
Yeah.
Like you'd find a word for something in Old Norse that's just a great word, and it almost feels as if the character springs from the sound of the name.
Yeah.
Sorry, does that not make sense?
No, absolutely. I mean, you can't discuss Tolkien creating anything without bringing in language. Like clearly, like that was his primary scholarly interest, and everything else kind of like springs out of that, and thus that's where a lot of these characters and species come from as well.
Yeah. So it seems that Tolkien actually derived the term orc from a usage in Beowulf. Beowulf is, of course, the great epic of Anglo-Saxon. It's an epic poem from the early Middle Ages. We don't know exactly when it was composed. It was written in Old English, which is the ancestor to modern English, but also which is, it's so unlike modern English that you can't just read it. It's basically like another language. You need a glossary or translation, basically, to understand it. And so the term specifically that appears in Beowulf is Orkneias or Orkneas. It is a creature that's mentioned during the introduction of the monster Grendel, the real first big bad that that Beowulf has to fight. Beowulf arrives at Hrothgar's Mead Hall, and the Mead Hall is being terrorized by attacks from this monster, Grendel. And so I'm going to read from the J. Leslie Hall translation of Beowulf in the part that mentions orcs, or the word Orcneos, at least. Hall translates, "For that bitter murder, the killing of Abel, all-ruling father, the kindred of Cain, crushed with his vengeance. In the feud he rejoiced not, but far away drove him from kindred and kind, that crime to atone for, meter of justice. Thence ill-favored creatures, elves and giants, monsters of ocean, came into being, and the giants that long time grappled with God, he gave them requital." Now, in the Hall translation here, there are a couple of different words that get translated as giants. One is the Old English gigantes, and the other is jotunes, which I think is where we also get the word jotun, like the Norse mythology giant. A couple of different kinds of monsters. So in the line that mentions Orcneus, it's jotunas and ilfa, giants and elves, and Orcneus, which I think here is translated as monsters of ocean. But other translations have chosen different terms for it, sometimes calling it a demon or a goblin or something like that. There's also an interesting translation note in the J. Leslie Hall version of Beowulf, which notes that when Grendel himself is introduced, the word used to describe him could be translated as demon, and often is, or could be translated as stranger. A literary and linguistic conflation of the unfamiliar person with the monster of hell. And J. Leslie Hall actually chooses stranger in this translation, making for an interesting set of lines. "A foe in the hall building, this horrible stranger, was Grendel entitled, the march stepper famous, who dwelt in the moor fens, the marsh and the fastness."
Ooh, I love that.
So if you think of Grendel as a stranger, this gets into some interesting territory about what monstrosity means, and that a lot of times our mythical monsters are sort of ways of mentally metabolizing concepts of people who are unfamiliar or who you worry might be threatening to you somehow.
Yeah, absolutely. But then also, just from a purely, like, on the other hand, like, just from an imaginative perspective, like, I hear that, and I just love the idea of Grendel as this, as the stranger, as this, you know, this being that is almost from another world, you know, because in many respects he is.
Well, and much like the orc that we were just talking about, Grendel here is given an unholy origin story, right? They say that he is descended from Cain, who in the biblical story murdered his brother Abel. Cain was, you know, the third human to exist, and Abel was the fourth. And Cain, I guess, got jealous of Abel having having good offerings to God that God was very pleased with, and so Cain murdered him. And then God comes to Cain saying, "Hey, where's your brother?" And Cain says, "Am I my brother's keeper?" So God curses Cain and sends him off wandering in the wilderness to the land of Nod. And Cain's offspring apparently become the monster Grendel. So it's like there's a sort of there's a generational curse that is passed down for that original crime. Now, in a 19th century glossary of Anglo-Saxon terms, the scholar Thomas Wright notes that orc means possibly hell devil or specter or goblin, and he notes that it is phonetically similar to Orcus, which was a Roman god of the underworld, I think somewhat regularly conflated with Satan during times of Christian syncretism.
Yeah, yeah. Orcus, of course, has come up on the podcast before. And this also brings to mind that line from William Blake that, of course, is adapted and switched around a little bit, more famously to most listeners in Blade Runner. But that line, "Fiery the angels rose as they rose, deep thunder rolled around their shores, indignant burning with the fires of Orc."
Oh, yeah, that's come up before. I know you like that one, and that's great. I mean, Blake is always great, but Orc there is different. Orc is not so much a monster there as kind of like I don't recall exactly, some kind of character.
Yeah, yeah, you're dealing with the Blake cinematic universe there as opposed to any of these others. I should add one thing. It's interesting that we don't have to really discuss what a goblin is in any of this. There's something about the goblin in particular that I think you'll find just about everywhere. Like we've discussed various Chinese folklores and mythologies before that involve something that is translated as a goblin. And it does seem to suggest that there is just sort of an intrinsic goblinness to the human imagination. Like there is a space preserved for the goblin that we don't even really need to even expand on too much.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think it's just there's a general fear of something that is evil, that is roughly shaped like a human and has human capabilities in a way, but cannot be reasoned with and has no mercy or morality and is just sort of like meanness and cruelty in human form or roughly human form.
Yeah, or even kind of I guess sometimes with the goblin, I get a sense of like the diminutive nature of the goblins suggest a hidden a supernatural element to it. Mm-hmm. And even though the idea of Tolkien's orcs, they kind of evolve out of an idea of a goblin, they become something different. They become something more like a human and therefore kind of divorced from like the supernatural world of pure fairies. In the same way that Tolkien's elves are something different than like the ideas of the fair folk or even the Tuatha De Danann that you find in Irish mythology.
Well, yeah, another thing that's funny is that by the time you get to Tolkien, suddenly elves are thought of as these sort of like superhumans. They're like humans, but they're like so beautiful and so graceful and so rational and good. But here in Beowulf, the elves just seem to be another type of monster. They're listed alongside the Jotunas and the monsters of the ocean. I mean, they're in the same line. It's Jotunas and Ilva and Orkneas all together.
Now, speaking of the idea of orc as being related to sea monsters, I of course looked up orc in Carol Rose's Giants, Monsters, and Dragons, one of my favorite books to look up various creatures. And actually, she has another book related to fairies. In the fairy book, she has a listing for orc, just saying it's one of Tolkien's creations, very short, not much to it. Mm-hmm. In the Monsters book, she mentions orc or orco, a monster described by Pliny the Elder in the Natural History, came out in 77 CE or thereabouts, and it's described as a very large oceanic creature said to be larger than a whale and capable of eating whales. It was known as orco later on and referenced in Orlando Furioso in 1516.
Oh, yeah, by the poet Lodovico Ariosto. So Orlando Furioso, I must admit this. We were talking about it before we started. I just figured out that this epic poem is not about a guy named Orlando Furioso. It means something like Orlando's frenzy or something. So Orlando is the hero of the story, and he slays a lot of monsters in it. But I looked it up in Orlando Furioso. It's in Canto 17 that the Orco monster is mentioned. And so I want to read from the William Stuart Rose translation. So we get the narration. While with much solace seated in a round, we from the chase expect our Lord's return, approaching us along the shore, astound, the orc, that fearful monster we discern. God grant, fair sir, he never may confound your eyesight with his semblance foul and stern. Better it is of him by fame to hear than to behold him by approaching near. To calculate the grisly monster's height, so measureless is he, exceeds all skill. Of fungus hue, in place of orbs of sight, their sockets two small bones like berries fill. Towards us, as I say, he speeds outright along the shore, and seems a moving hill. Tusks jutting out like savage swine he shows, a breast with drivel foul and pointed nose. Okay, so what do we know about this monster? He's too tall to calculate his height. No one has the skill to calculate how high he is. And that makes it sound like he must be, like, leaving the atmosphere. Mm-hmm. He also he's of fungus hue, and I guess there are funguses of a lot of different hues. And he, in place of eyeballs, he has bones that are like berries.
Now, up until that point, I'm definitely picturing what I think this is, but then the tusks kind of throw it off because the tusks sound like more something you would see, of course, in an actual tusk sea creature, but also in the fabulous chimerical sea monster that you see in various maps.
Oh, yeah, exactly. Like the kind that's like a wild boar's face on a whale's body. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I think something like that might be kind of imagined here, except he's advancing along the shore, so he seems to be able to leave the water. I don't know.
Well, it brings to mind, and because there does seem to be, there is a connection here. So when you read this, I could not help but picture the orca, the killer whale, you know, because there's something about, like, you know, fungus hue in place of orbs of sight, imagining those big white eye spots that are, of course, not their eyes, even though it's almost impossible to look at a killer whale and not think of that as their eyes. Uh-huh. Their eyes are actually much, you know, smaller and are there.
Those big eye spots, I think, actually make killer whales cuter than they would be otherwise.
They look less like the vicious wolves of the sea that they are. But yeah, there is this connection between Orcus and Orcinus orca. That's the scientific name for killer whales. Orcinus meaning belonging to Orcus, or simply the kingdom of the dead. The Roman idea of orco sea monsters was or became associated with the killer whale.
Yeah, I guess that's right. And I want to be clear. I think a minute ago we described the killer whale as vicious, which we don't mean in a negative moral sense, but we do mean in a descriptive sense about, like, their behavior as they prey on sharks, which is just awesome.
Concerning orcas and their natural prey, I think viciousness is a well-deserved adjective. Yeah, watch any nature documentary about their hunting of baby whales, and you will agree.
Yeah.
But then again, hey, it's that's the world. They're just doing their part in it.
The blessings of Melkor.
All right. On that note, we're going to take a break. But when we come back, we'll talk more about orcs.
Hey, guys, you know what this playground could use? A wine country, huh?
A redwood forest would be cool.
Ski slopes!
Wait! Did we just invent California?
Discover why California is the ultimate playground at visitcalifornia.com.
Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. If you haven't heard of Visible, now you have. They're the wireless carrier that's making wireless visible. It's in the name. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. Having a one-line plan means you only need you to save. No estranged roommates, exes, cousins twice removed, or AI-powered humanoid robots needed. And because $25 a month really means $25 a month, you can call, text, stream, whatever, as much as you want without worrying about getting dinged at the end of the month.
No hidden fees, no surprises. No, really. It's like the old saying goes, you can't judge a book by its cover, but you can judge a company by its name. So spread the word. Tell all your friends there's a wireless company out there with transparency in their name, and they're called Visible. Start saving on wireless today at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can waste another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can conquer it. I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. Any road. The steeper, the better. Because my all-new Santa Fe is available with H-Track all-wheel drive, so I can hit the trail without a worry in the world. Heck, with three rows and best-in-class rear cargo space, I can pack the whole family in with all our gear. We've got available dual wireless charging for our phones, so we'll never lose touch with civilization, and we won't lose touch with the primordial power of Mother Earth. So which is it? Waste the weekend, or do something a little more epic? And conquer it in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
This episode is brought to you by Navy Federal Credit Union. At Navy Federal, it's been the mission to help the military community for over 90 years. And not just help them, but do everything to make sure they not only grow, but flourish. That's why Navy Federal Credit Union has all kinds of great savings and investment options, like share certificates with sky-high rates. So don't hesitate. Start growing your finances today with a variety of savings and investment options. Navy Federal Credit Union. Our members are the mission. Savings products insured by NCUA. Investment products are not insured, not obligations of Navy Federal and may lose value.
All right, we're back. Now, there are certainly a number of ways to crunch the idea of an orc, of Tolkien's orc, a humanoid other that is also not human in significant ways. I have to come back to something that that author Terence Hawkins wrote about in his novel American Neolithic, of which there's a revised edition out, I believe. It has to do with a Neanderthal surviving into modern days. But there's this wonderful line where the Neanderthal character is speaking to the reader and says, quote, "You, for whom we have always been the other, our existence buried deep in your racial memories since the time when glaciers girdled the world and the contest between man and animal was yet to be decided. We haunt your legends as we haunt your dreams, misshapen versions of yourself, bad copies, formerly kobolds or gremlins, now Morlocks and orcs." So in this line, basically, it's the idea is that there might be some connection between the idea of orcs or Morlocks or other type beings, and maybe the notion that humans did live alongside Neanderthals for a period of time and played at least some role in their destruction.
Well, depending on how you define destruction, because, of course, we do see the disappearance of the Neanderthal as a distinct branch of the Homo genus, but also it does appear that Homo sapiens and Neanderthals also intermingled.
Yeah, we went a good deal into this in our Almost Cannibals episode, because we were basically, there was one point we were discussing the idea of cannibalism by Neanderthals, by early humans, and you see examples of cannibalism in both groups, but there's less evidence to suggest that, say, humans ate all the Neanderthals or the Neanderthals ate humans. I mean, there are a number of open questions about what exactly happened between Neanderthals and humans, to what extent anything happened. A lot of sources seem to indicate that there was probably at least a competition for resources, if not something more, nefarious. Yeah. With, of course, the Neanderthals eventually fading away, leaving only us. But I take that back. Also, some trace of Neanderthals within our own genetics. Now, while it's interesting to think of a true humanoid other and how human society would process its downfall, there's another huge issue to consider, and that is our tendency to dehumanize due to xenophobic, nationalistic, and/or racist attitudes. And this is an issue that certainly comes up in the consideration of orcs.
Yeah, I think one of the most difficult things when you dig into the history of ideas about monsters, as much as we love them today and they're fun in the forms we have them, they may often have their origins in ideas that if we were to fully understand them, we would find quite repugnant. I mean, I think a lot of the origins of monster legends are probably in some process of dehumanizing people who are human.
Yeah, it's truly heartbreaking, because you want monsters to be this pure escapism. Mm-hmm. But then, when you start pulling the various threads, you often find yourself confronting something like this. And if nothing else, you confront the basic idea that monsters always emerge from, if not one particular time, they emerge out of different times. Mm-hmm. And Tolkien's orcs especially, I mean, they're emerging out of 20th century Europe, out of a period during which there were two devastating world wars. Certainly there's plenty of European racism and xenophobia going around at the time, the wartime demonization of the enemy. These are all elements in the soup, no matter how much you want to focus on these just being purely fictional beings in another world, or in a world that is inspired purely out of the scholarly consideration of myths and fairy tales.
Right. I mean, I think at the very least, what you can definitely say about the orc, no matter what else we know about them, is that they are a dehumanized form of the enemy to be represented in war. And in a way, if Tolkien was trying to consciously sort of recreate something like a mythology, we see something like this in lots of mythologies. It is, of course, common for humans to dehumanize their enemies and to think of them as something, less than the people like us.
Right. And I mean, we see this everywhere. I mean, this is one of the reasons that arguably that zombie fiction has been so successful is that it presents a completely, ethically acceptable enemy that can just be eradicated without any second consideration.
Yeah. You remember when we did the episode about daydreaming, and one of the studies mm-hmm. we looked at discovered that one of the most common things that people daydream about is they just sort of fantasize about violent conflict. The people, yeah. they think like, oh, if there was a fight, what would I do? There's this kind of thing. And so obviously people's brains are drawn to this kind of scenario to fantasize about, for understandable reasons. Like that's where a lot of potential risk lies. And you want to imagine like, well, what could I do to get out of this? How could I win? That kind of thing. But then also, I think about in Lord of the Rings, there's a part where Samwise Gamgee, he recognizes a fallen soldier from the other side, from somebody who's fighting for Sauron, but is a human fighting for Sauron, one of the men from Harad. And Samwise looks at him and he feels bad. He says, wait a minute, was this man really evil, or what kind of lies or threats brought him here so far from home? And wouldn't he rather be living at peace?
That's interesting.
It's a kind of strange moment where suddenly out of this otherwise kind of Manichaean good versus evil war, fantasy war with a non-human enemy, suddenly there's this breakthrough where one of the characters on the supposed good side thinks, wait a minute, aren't the people on the other side humans too? Aren't they, don't they have lives? Don't they have moral complexities behind their story?
This is one of the things that you see time and time again in this discussion. And I want to drive home that this is this has been a topic of continual consideration by Tolkien scholars and literary cultural scholars alike, both in reference to the original works and the original writings of J.R.R. Tolkien and these various film incarnations. Because on one hand, there's this idea, if you read, in our cold opening, this idea of the orcs as just this purely inhuman thing just made out of savagery. That sounds more in keeping with the zombie myth, right? Just like no ethical problems at all. But along the lines of this example of a human fighting for Sauron, there are plenty of examples in The Lord of the Rings where Tolkien does engage in a certain humanization of the orcs. Like they're given some sense of individuality. Mm-hmm. I believe there are, scenes where they've been taken captive by the orcs and they're overhearing orc conversations.
Merry and Pippin, when they're kidnapped by the orcs, they sort of interact with the orcs in a way that suggests to me, at least, that the orcs are sentient. They're not like robots. They're not just evil killing machines. Like they've got motivations of their own.
Yeah. So that makes everything a lot more complicated. Everything we're about to talk about a lot more complicated.
Yeah.
Now we can't possibly cover the entire discourse on this topic. It looks like there's some very good sources out there that you can find. I ran across a book that is cited in a source that I'm going to mention by Dimitra Fimi, titled "Tolkien, Race, and Cultural History," that is supposedly quite good. Some of the key issues that are often brought up about orcs are that orcs are clearly described as having dark skin. Orcs are described as being quote-unquote slant-eyed. And there's this sense that, orcs are human-shaped and are more or less human-like, but then they are also less than human or described as less than human. And it is often suggested that, nothing but brutal violence against the orcs is permissible, and that they should just be eradicated by the higher species of Middle Earth. And I mean, some of this, I think, might be getting back to the Tolkien duality here. I think part of it is just by if you start telling stories about something, you're going to end up humanizing it. Mm-hmm. So I can see where you could start with your just completely irredeemable enemy, but then you can't help but humanize it a bit in the same way that, in the Clone Wars, you have the droid army. The droids are like a great example of an enemy army that is set up to be easily and dispatched without any ethical quandaries.
Yeah.
And you still see this kind of creep in Clone Wars storytelling, in which you'll end up sympathizing with the droids. You can't help but apply sort of human characteristics to the droids at times.
Mm-hmm.
Now, one of the works I was looking at for this is a paper by Robert T. Talley Jr., Let Us Now Praise Famous Orcs, Simple Humanity in Tolkien's Inhuman Creatures. This was published in Mythlore back in 2010. And he looks at both sides of the discussion here, basically. Now, Talley ultimately does not himself accuse Tolkien of racism, but he does outline much of the evidence that can be cited in such a charge, admitting, quote, it is true that no one can read about the, quote, swart and, quote, slant-eyed orcs so many times without becoming offended. And he also points out that Tolkien himself notoriously wrote in one of his letters, quote, the orcs are definitely stated to be corruptions of the human form seen in elves and men. They are or were squat, broad, flat-nosed, sallow-skinned, with wide mouths and slant eyes. In fact, degraded and repulsive versions of the, to Europeans, least lovely Mongol types.
That is not a good sentiment.
Yeah. And according to Anderson Rurik III in Why is the Only Good Orc a Dead Orc, published in MFS Modern Fiction Studies, Tolkien's friend C.S. Lewis even made passing mention of racism in light of the book's first publication, but apparently did not pursue the idea all that much. So, you know, it seems to have been something that was at least in the conversation concerning orcs for quite some time, and maybe even on Tolkien's mind, at least at times. I mean, I can't help but I'd forgotten that passage about the human servants of Mordor, but that's interesting as well. I've also seen it argued that this sort of view of the racial enemy tied up with the orc was also readily exhibited in World War I and World War II propaganda against both Germans and the Japanese, where you see like a monstrous racial version of the enemy depicted in propaganda posters. And then on top of that, we're talking about an era of eugenics, ideas of racial purity, all that going on in the background. And this is ultimately, again, the world that these works emerge from. Now, Fimi concludes, according to Talley, that Tolkien's, quote, objectionable racial characterizations are consistent with the discourse of his time and, in any event, consistent with the, quote, hierarchical world in which his mythic history unfolds. Now, that being said, I don't think that makes it any easier for modern readers or viewers, you know, once you start focusing on these elements, once you start, you know, noticing them in your reading of the text or the viewing of the movies that spawned from them.
You know, you see modern adaptations dealing with this in almost diametrically opposed ways, right? Because one way you could deal with it is to try to embrace even harder the distinctions that would make, you know, whatever kind of like monster enemy it is clearly not human. You know, you want to go full zombie or full robot,
right?
To suggest that like, no, the orcs can't be, they're not a metaphor for like in any people. They're not human at all. They're like, you know, bio robots or something. And then the other direction would be to actually try to humanize them more and make them seem more complicated. But yeah, it is true. I mean, like much fantasy and epic writing is this way, but as they currently exist in the story, the orcs are in this uncomfortable middle position where they are sort of human, but they're not treated with the fairness that we would hope should be afforded to all sentient creatures.
Yeah, and it's the ambiguity of it that makes it difficult. And you know, and it's also, I would say, with Tolkien, it doesn't seem to be nearly as clear-cut a situation as we have, say, with H.P. Lovecraft, you know, who we have such, you know, damning examples of racist sentiment in his private letters, and then when you look at his works of fiction in light of those letters, I mean, you can't ignore these elements in his work. You know, Tolkien's writings certainly have been accused of containing wrong or outmoded attitudes to race, with orcs very much at the center of all of this. But then you have defenders pointing out, well, okay, Tolkien himself was anti-racist, both in peacetime and during the two world wars. I don't know. You're still left with what we still have, just continual discussion of, like, how are we supposed to process Tolkien's work as a modern consumer and a modern thinker.
Well, I mean, I guess one of the ways that we're left to deal with it is just to don't let yourself get Lord of the Rings brain, or at least certainly don't let yourself get orc brain thinking outside of the fantasy of the text. You know, the real world does not have orcs in it. Like, you know, all the people, even people you might be in conflict against, are human. And that, you know, and to maybe lean more into the Samwise Gamgee way of thinking about things, to always try to remember that even somebody who you might be at war with is still a human, and they've got their own motivations. They are morally complex in the same way that you are.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, I think in one of Tolkien's letters, he even said something similar, where he's like, well, in the real world, you have orcs on both sides of a conflict.
Yeah.
Because I guess in a sense, the orcs is us, right? I want to note, too, that I thought Dungeons & Dragons, the game, the company behind it, they recently made mention of some of this concerning orcs in a diversity statement. They put this out. This was this year. They wrote, quote, throughout the 50-year history of D&D, some of the peoples in the game, orcs and drow being two prime examples, have been characterized as monstrous and evil, using descriptions that are painfully reminiscent of how real-world ethnic groups have been and continue to be denigrated. That's just not right, and it's not something we believe in. Despite our conscious efforts to the contrary, we have allowed some of those old descriptions to reappear in the game. We recognize that to live our values, we have to do an even better job in handling these issues. If we make mistakes, our priority is to make things right. And then they go on to stress a forward-facing commitment to portraying orcs and drow as, quote, just as morally and culturally complex as other peoples, which I think is a way to go, especially considering orcs and drow have such a prominent role in Dungeons and Dragons storytelling, the drow being the dark elves of the Underdark.
Yeah. The more I think about it, the more I think that the clear dividing line really, I guess, would have to be sentience, right? That there, there was an idea here, maybe in older versions of D&D, apparently somewhat ambiguously represented in Lord of the Rings, that there are some types of people or types of creatures that are sentient. They're thinking beings like us, but they are also wholly evil.
Right.
And in a way, that's sort of self-contradictory, right? Like, you know, a sentient being couldn't be as an entire people wholly evil, because their sentience would sort of necessarily imply that there is, you know, that there is moral complexity to them.
Yeah, I mean, it works when you're talking about, I mean, basically it comes down to the alignment system in Dungeons and Dragons, which on an individual level doesn't really work in the real world. Like, I mean, the idea, I mean, am I neutral evil, or am I neutral good? Like, I think in reality, we have multiple alignments in ourselves at all times, and it's about nurturing the alignments that are the person we want to be, you know? And then certainly when you get into a species-wide alignment, like, what is humanity's alignment? I mean, it depends on what we're doing at any given time. It depends on what you're focusing on. I mean, there are aspects of humanity's, you know, role in the world that would seem, you know, at least lawful evil, or neutral evil, and there are other things that are not so. It's one of these things that whether it works well within a game context, as long as you're not thinking too hard about it, I guess.
I mean, ultimately, I don't think it's ever going to go away, the convention of having various types of fantasy storytelling in which there is some kind of conflict and the enemy of the heroes is an army of monsters. But I guess that mindset has its place within fiction, as just the same way a horror mindset does or anything like that. You know, don't pull it out into the real world and try to use it on humans.
Yeah. All right. On that note, we're going to take a break, but we'll be right back.
Hey, guys, you know what this playground could use? A wine country, huh?
A redwood forest would be cool.
Ski slopes!
Wait! Did we just invent California?
Discover why California is the ultimate playground at visitcalifornia.com.
Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. If you haven't heard of Visible, now you have. They're the wireless carrier that's making wireless visible. It's in the name. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. Having a one-line plan means you only need you to save. No estranged roommates, exes, cousins twice removed, or AI-powered humanoid robots needed. And because $25 a month really means $25 a month, you can call, text, stream, whatever, as much as you want without worrying about getting dinged at the end of the month.
No hidden fees, no surprises. No, really. It's like the old saying goes, you can't judge a book by its cover, but you can judge a company by its name. So spread the word. Tell all your friends there's a wireless company out there with transparency in their name, and they're called Visible. Start saving on wireless today at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can waste another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can conquer it. I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. Any road. The steeper, the better. Because my all-new Santa Fe is available with H-Track all-wheel drive, so I can hit the trail without a worry in the world. Heck, with three rows and best-in-class rear cargo space, I can pack the whole family in with all our gear. We've got available dual wireless charging for our phones, so we'll never lose touch with civilization, and we won't lose touch with the primordial power of Mother Earth. So which is it? Waste the weekend or do something a little more epic and conquer it in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
This episode is brought to you by Navy Federal Credit Union. At Navy Federal, it's been the mission to help the military community for over 90 years. And not just help them, but do everything to make sure they not only grow, but flourish. That's why Navy Federal Credit Union has all kinds of great savings and investment options, like share certificates with sky-high rates. So don't hesitate. Start growing your finances today with a variety of savings and investment options. Navy Federal Credit Union. Our members are the mission. Savings products insured by NCUA. Investment products are not insured, not obligations of Navy Federal and may lose value.
All right, we're back. So let's move back to the in-universe concept of the orc and consider how we might apply science to the situation. So first of all, I'd like to refer back to the writings of R. Scott Baker, who I've mentioned on the show before, and heck, he's been on the show a couple times, hasn't he? But he wrote this Second Apocalypse saga, which takes a lot of inspiration from Tolkien, but applies a different philosophical and at times science fictional lens to everything. And in the place of orcs, he presents these creatures that are called the Shrank, which are described as one of the quote-unquote weapon races that were engineered by the big baddies in this series, the alien Inkarai. So these are depraved, like thoroughly inhuman creatures from another world, the Inkarai, and they've taken members of the elf-like non-men in this world, and they've used the techni, or the old science, to twist them into savage creatures of the basest and most violent instinct, often described as retaining the beautiful faces of the non-men, only twisted with like raw, violent emotion, and with kind of emaciated bodies. And so they're engineered to combat the non-men warriors, while also consisting on next to nothing. Like they were told that they live off of grubs and insects that they find on as they scavenge other lands that are otherwise fruitless, that could otherwise not support an army at all. And they're all part of the scheme to essentially destroy the world and eradicate conscious beings from it. And so I think it's an interesting take on the idea of an orc, or at least an orc as an engineered warrior being, more or less an organic robot made for savagery and war that is itself incapable of self-reflection. And if you're indeed the Inkarai or a Dark Lord of Middle-earth, it makes sense, I guess, to create such servants. And indeed, this whole concept probably gets closer to the idea of like a zombie army or a droid army or a subservient reanimated skeleton army, you know, something that is just purely the tool of the great adversary.
Well, yeah, and tying into something I was talking about earlier, it seems to me significant, probably the most significant thing, that they are imagined as basically being not sentient or not able to reflect on their own behavior.
Yeah.
Which, I mean, at that point, it does seem like that being probably does lack whatever it is that we think of as most significant to be human, right? Like if you're not capable of reflecting on your own behavior.
Yeah. And with Baker's work, yeah, there's this idea, first of all, that it is not conscious. He's going to tell you if a creature's conscious or not. That's kind of his whole thing. But then also the idea that they are definitely engineered. They are a thing that is created. They are a new creation based on, some designs or raw materials from this other species.
Mm-hmm. You know, Peter Watts in the novel Echopraxia, I recall, imagined something like this, but it is a type of human soldier who has had their nervous system modified essentially so that they have the ability to at will turn off their consciousness during combat, essentially to become a more efficient killer. So the brain still works the same, except it's just not conscious while it's fighting. And apparently this makes you better at being a soldier.
Interesting. So I think these are interesting ways to think of a particular like weapon species in a fantasy or sci-fi context. But I was also interested to see what else could be gleaned science-wise from the orcs of Middle Earth. So I turned to the book The Science of Middle Earth by Henry Gee, who is himself a longtime editor at the science journal Nature, as well as a paleontologist and evolutionary biologist. And so he covers a great deal from Middle Earth in this book. But beginning with the sixth chapter, he begins to discuss orcs a bit. And the sixth chapter is titled Inventing the Orcs. He spends a fair amount of time discussing some of what we've already discussed, like where do we get the word orc? What does it mean? Its ties into mythology. But he also points out, okay, let's talk about how they're made and how they reproduce. So he starts by pointing out that there's a fair amount of incongruity concerning the origins of orcs in Tolkien's Middle Earth. You can look at various descriptions and cinematic depictions that on one hand make them look like they're bred, and on another it looks like they're created via torture. And if it's torture, are we talking about something that is more... Is this the way we're describing something that's being done to the body that can't be understood, like something like the techne, something like a sci-fi genetic engineering, or is it something psychological, right?
I seem to recall in the Peter Jackson movie that at least some of them, maybe this was only the Uruk-hai or maybe it was all of the orcs, but somehow the servants of Saruman were being like grown out of the earth, like they came up out of the ground.
Yeah, that's something that the Gee discusses as well. Yeah, this idea that there's something that's just like pulled out of the earth, like this sort of primal creation. They're just made of mud and stone.
Or maybe they're plants or fungus.
Maybe there's some sort of fungal element as well. So he didn't get into the now I'm thinking about the fungal orc idea. That's a whole different theory. But the author here, he does discuss one interesting evolutionary aspect of orcs in Tolkien. And that is that we have in an orc army a collection of varying orc subspecies, which he says would ultimately fit well with the idea that orcs have, in periods of decline, withdrawn to various corners of the world. You know, this bunch withdraws to the Misty Mountains, this one withdraws to these wastelands over here, etc. Mm-hmm. So he writes the following, quote, "The enormous variety of orcs, which, as it turns out, is crucial to the story, can be seen as a consequence of the smallness and isolation of populations evolving in their own particular ways to suit local conditions, their isolation enhanced by mutual antipathy and incomprehension. Evolutionary theory tells us that evolution happens faster and has more idiosyncratic results when populations are small and isolated. So Tolkien's portrait of the orcs as a collection of very diverse kindreds is biologically very accurate, except, that is, for one thing. Sex."
You know, one thing you could not accuse the Lord of the Rings of is having too much sex in it.
Yeah. Yeah, apparently Gee mentions one paper that is like saying there's no sex in Middle Earth. Like, what does that mean? Like, if you take that literally, does it mean like sexual reproduction is not a thing in Middle Earth? I think that would probably be going a bit far. But in trying to piece together exactly where orcs come from and how they reproduce, it does become a little sticky.
Yeah. I mean, there is remarkably little sex in Lord of the Rings. I mean, people are described as descending from parents, basically. So you imagine there is some sexual reproduction going on. I remember Gimli at some point gets very, excited about the idea of how beautiful Galadriel is, but they're just not very sexually charged stories. And this is kind of interesting if Tolkien is in a way trying to create a sort of epic mythology, because I don't know, most world mythologies are pretty crammed with sex.
Yeah. I mean, people are always begetting other folks, right?
Yeah.
Whereas in the Tolkien books, like even with the orcs, there's occasionally like reference to one being the son of another, you know, of parentage, but there's not a lot of detail there. And certainly there are no scenes depicting it. So Guy basically points out, well, if we're talking about evolution and the biology, the orc, like sex is obviously an important part of the equation. But of course, we have little or no evidence of orc sex in the books, which I don't know. That seems a little maybe nitpicky to say, but because there, I don't know, there are apparently five references to orc reproduction aside from discussion of creation or breeding by others, which Guy thinks is minuscule. But to me, that kind of sounds like a lot. I would, if you asked me to guess how many references to orc reproduction there are in the book, I would have guessed like maybe one.
I would have guessed zero.
I mean, I think I vaguely remember a passage where one character's talking about, well, the orcs have been reproducing in the mountains. There are a lot of them. Like, that would have been the only one that would have come to my mind. Not only is there no mention of actual orc sex, there's no mention of female orcs, and this is perhaps more significant. Now, naturally, this doesn't mean there were no female orcs, nor does it mean that there was no orc sex. You know, no more than the absence of sex from the rest of the books mean that sex didn't exist for other species of Middle Earth. But he does point out that the idea, you know, that we could compare this to the idea of a purely manufactured orc species, much in the same way that the, you know, the clones and the droids in Star Wars are created. And this would actually be in keeping with the industrialized warfare of the world wars, you know, full of mechanized artillery and this overall degradation of the individual soldier, as well as the overall, quote, emasculating effects of industrialization in the world. So in other words, perhaps there's no female or male orc at all. There's only just neutral flesh machines that serve this fallen god.
You know, it's interesting that Tolkien was very he would very strenuously reject the idea that Lord of the Rings was an allegory for any particular war. Like, I think the mm-hmm. thing most often raised is like people saying like, oh, I see, you know, it's supposed to be about World War II and Hitler is Sauron and, you know, the orcs are the Nazis and all that, which, I mean, obviously coming out of the World War II era, it would probably be hard not to try to make that comparison in like an epic struggle.
Yeah.
But Tolkien always, like, he thoroughly rejected the idea that Lord of the Rings was an allegory for any particular historical events on Earth. You know, he in fact thought allegories were quite stupid and he did not like them. But nevertheless, this is one where it's like really hard to miss that what would seem like allegorical significance, the way that the Mordor war machine it has these tones that so resemble the production lines of mechanized warfare going into World War II.
Yeah, indeed. In fact, this was interesting. I'd never heard this, but Guy pointed out in the book as well that there's an earlier version of the lost tale, The Fall of Gondolin, which features a siege not by orcs and trolls, but by, quote, vast articulated fire-breathing machines. Tolkien apparently later abandoned this idea in favor of living creatures, you know, the orcs, the trolls, etc. But at least at one point, there was this vision of the armies of Mordor being like mechanical, industrial creations.
Yeah, and I think it's there in the book still, even though the orcs are biological in some way, mythological, biological. The armies of Mordor, I think, are very much seen as like a sort of an industrializing wave, something that destroys the natural landscape and replaces it with industry and machinery and ash and smoke.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's and certainly you look at Mordor, and what is Mordor but this sort of geologic vision of like pure industrial doom, right?
Yeah,
I mean,
no trees grow there. You know, it's just like it's a vast asphalt parking lot full of factories for weapons.
Yeah, its exports are war, weapons, and volcanic ash. That seems to be it. Now, all this being said, there are mention of orcs like breeding in the wild. So they do seem to reproduce in the wild in some manner. But who knows? It could be like a Jurassic Park situation, right? Where there's some sort of you know, mutation that occurs or something. You know, Guy suggests, okay,
they're making their own lysine. Yeah.
Yeah. Maybe Guy suggests, well, maybe orcs lay eggs. Maybe that's what it is. Ultimately, he says, you know, if it's. There are a number of different ideas you could propose since there's no real discussion of it in the book, as long as it doesn't break anything else in the book, I mean, it's all kind of fair game. Like he has some fun with the idea that perhaps orcs are eusocial insects, and there's like an unseen orc queen that does all the egg production. And indeed, he points out that the goblins of the Misty Mountains and the orcs of Moria behave much like an ant colony in some respects.
That would be interesting, but again, I think in the few glimpses we do get into orc psychology, the orcs seem far too selfish and individualistic to be eusocial animals, right? Like, I mean, the individual worker ant's own bodily existence matters quite little to it compared to, you know, protecting the queen and the reproductive possibilities of the hive. Individual orcs really do seem to sort of be in it for themselves when they can, you know, when they think they can get away with something.
Yeah, absolutely. Now another idea that he brings up is, okay, perhaps orcs reproduce by parthenogenesis or cloning. You know, he writes that this could work well, especially when you're thinking about the shrinking habitats that orcs have during their times of decline. But this would also mean that all orcs would inherently need to be female, which also might work with the fact that there's, you know, never any mention of male and female orcs. Orcs are kind of presented as sexless, even though they're, you know, they're described with male terminology. I mean, maybe we're just talking about an all-female species.
Maybe we're just getting the story told through the, like, paternalistic lens of how the men and the elves view things.
Yeah, could be. Oh, and speaking of elves, another thing that he brings up is, okay, if we go back to this other origin story, the idea that Morgoth or Melkor, that they basically, like, tortured the elves in order to make orcs. Well, he points out that, okay, well, if you were to torture a bunch of elves and break them and so forth, and then have them breed them, you're not going to produce orcs, you're going to produce more elves. You know, and certainly they could have, you know, the Dark Lord could use this technique over time to, you know, encourage orcish traits, adapt to a hellish dungeon environment. But this would ultimately require periods of evolutionary time that are far beyond anything we're presented with in the Middle Earth timeline.
No, I mean, this is a more mythological way of imagining how traits are established in a species. You know, it's kind of a magical Lamarckianism.
Yeah, and he writes that ultimately Tolkien was, of course, more concerned, well, certainly with linguistic aspects of everything. Like, what does it mean that orcs have a language, that orcs speak? Mm-hmm. Well, they speak in a more primitive tongue, you know, that sort of thing. But then also Tolkien was more concerned with theological ramifications, like what happens to the soul of the elf if it is made into an orc, you know? Mm-hmm. So there's this whole line of thinking as well. So all of this was far more on Tolkien's brain as opposed to, you know, evolutionary biology. But what if everything in Middle Earth is actually a mushroom? Like, absolutely everything, even the ants, mushrooms. I'll have to carry that with me on the next reread.
Oh, I want to come back to ants this October, because I've got almost kind of like an evil ant thing I want to do.
Oh, well, that sounds promising to me. So let's see. At this point, we've talked about, you know, orcs as a problem faced by the other species of Middle Earth. We've talked about problematic aspects of the orc as a fictional creation. We've talked about the problems with orc reproduction, or figuring out exactly what orc reproduction consists of. But I understand you have one more orc problem for us here, Joe.
Well, so this only relates to hobbits and orcs in a completely arbitrary way, but it's actually, I think it's maybe the most delightful of all the things that we're going to talk about today.
All right, let's do it.
So if you're a puzzle nerd, there's actually going to be a puzzle that you can pause the episode to try to solve. And this is going to be the hobbits and orcs problem. Now, my main source here is a chapter in the Cambridge Handbook of Thinking and Reasoning, which is just the jolliest of reads, but it's actually more interesting than you might expect. That sounds incredibly dry. It's only somewhat dry. But specifically, I'm looking at a chapter on problem solving by Laura R. Novick, who is at Vanderbilt University, and Miriam Bassock, who is at the University of Washington. Both are psychology professors who study cognition and problem solving. Now, the study of problem solving is actually a really fascinating field, or combination of fields. It's highly relevant to our lives. And I would say, to be fair, it encompasses actually at least two main questions that are very different from one another. One is a question primarily for mathematics and computer science, and this is the study of problem-solving algorithms, such as those for search or sorting, and the study of which methods are actually the most efficient at solving different kinds of problems. The other question is one for psychology and cognitive neuroscience, which is, regardless of what methods are actually the most efficient, what do our brains tend to do? You know, when a human is faced with a problem, what kinds of algorithms and methods do we actually use in practice?
Okay.
So where do the orcs come in? Well, one puzzle that has been used to study human tendencies in problem solving is known as the Hobbits and Orcs problem, and it's a variation on the classic river crossing puzzle. Robert, have you ever done one of these where, you know, you've got a wolf and a sheep and a cabbage all together on one side of a river, and you got to figure out how to get them across? Do you know what I'm talking about?
Oh, I don't have a strong memory of this now.
Okay, well, here's this version. Okay, we're going to go to the Brandywine River, the one that separates, I believe, Bree from Buckland. Now, at the Brandywine River, on the north side of the river, you've got three hobbits and three orcs, and your goal is to get all six creatures across the river to the other side. Now, there's a boat that you can use to ferry them across, but there are a couple of major limitations. First of all, the boat can only hold two creatures at a time, and there always has to be at least one creature, at least one hobbit or orc, in the boat in order to row it. So you can't send the boat across the river empty. Second, you can never leave hobbits in a place where they are outnumbered by orcs, or, of course, the orcs will eat them. And now your goal in this problem is to figure out what sequence of steps you can use to get all the hobbits and the orcs to the other side of the river without breaking any of the rules. Now, it's not necessary, but if you do want to pause the episode here and try to solve the puzzle yourself, go for it. I'll give you a hint that it can be solved in what's usually considered 14 steps or 14 stages. Okay, so I'm not going to read out all of the steps to the solution here, but you can look it up and find it online. If you're stumped, I'm sure just Google it. It'll come up. One reason this particular puzzle is useful for studying problem solving is in studying what's known as the hill climbing heuristic. Now here, Novick and Bassock described the hill climbing heuristic as a problem solving technique in which, quote, at each step, the solver applies the operator that yields a new state that appears to be the most similar to the goal state. In other words, you know what your end goal looks like, and at each step you do whatever it is that appears to get you into a state that looks more similar to the goal state. So if your goal is to get to the highest altitude, at each step you just try going uphill, hence hill climbing. Now, studies in cognitive psychology show that we use the hill climbing heuristic a lot. Novick and Bassock cite the example of Chronicle, McGregor, and Ormerod in 2004, who found that people naturally use the hill climbing heuristic in a task that involved sorting coins into a particular order. What you probably do is just like keep moving the coins in a way that makes them look closer to the final order they're supposed to be in until you get there. In the context of the Hobbits and Orcs game, hill climbing would mean that at each stage, you just try to find whatever legal move will get the most creatures to the goal side of the river and off of the starting side of the river without breaking the rules. And studies have found that people do use the hill climbing heuristic to generate steps when solving the Hobbits and Orcs problem, and for the most part, it works. But also, two studies by Thomas and Greeno, both in 1974, found that people hit a major roadblock around step number 7 or 8 in the game because, as Novick and Bassock write, quote, the correct move at this point, in fact, the only non-backtracking move, is for one hobbit and one orc to take the boat back to the original side of the river. So essentially, while it must be done in order to complete the puzzle, it looks counterproductive because the only way you can finish the puzzle is to cause a temporary net migration of creatures to the wrong side of the river. It's a necessary step, but it actually ends up looking less similar to your goal state than the step before it did. And the studies by Thomas and Greeno both found that people really get hung up at this step. It was the step of the problem where both the probability probability of a player making an illegal move and the time taken to decide on the next move suddenly go way up compared to other steps. And Novick and Bassock talk about how these studies highlight one of the inherent weaknesses of the hill climbing heuristic. Sometimes, in all kinds of problem-solving scenarios, you have to move backwards or laterally in order to reach your end goal. Like, actual mountain climbers know this in a quite literal sense. You can't always reach the highest peak just by going straight up. A lot of times you have to go back down to reach a path that can actually be ascended. Other times you reach what's known as false peaks, which are places that seem like the peak as you're ascending until you get there, and then you realize that you are only at the local highest altitude, and there's actually a higher peak just over here. And this means that it really pays to think about what problem-solving methods you're using without realizing it, whether those methods are the best suited to the kind of problem you're facing. The hill climbing heuristic can be very useful for problems in which the solution space could be represented as a kind of single peak, like one mountain on an otherwise flat plain with an unobstructed slope. If the solution space is like that, then basically, yeah, you just keep trying to go uphill until you get to the highest point. But hill climbing can be ruinous for problems where the solution space could be represented as kind of like a landscape with multiple different hills and peaks and valleys. Because if you just keep trying to go uphill, what you're going to do here is end up climbing to the top of whichever hill is closest to your starting position. And then you'll just be stuck there, because even if you know there's a higher peak you have to get to, you have to go downhill to get to it. So I think what this means for our lives is, if you're stuck on a task, it can be really useful to ask yourself, am I inappropriately trying to use the hill climbing heuristic? Do I actually need to temporarily move further away from my goal in order to actually get there? And in myself, one thing that immediately came to mind as an example of where I find myself doing this is sometimes when I'm writing, I'm working on a paragraph or a page or something that just does not feel right. Like, I know it is not going right, and I'm trying to fix it by tinkering around with word choice and junk like that, when in actuality, the best path to my goal would be, of course, to just delete what I have and start over in a different way.
Yeah. Sometimes I think I encounter this when I'm painting. Like, if I'm working on a miniature, and like, you reach that point where, I mean, I guess with the miniature, it's sometimes harder. I mean, yeah, you can just paint over everything and apply a new base coat. You can use something to strip the existing paint off of it. But like sometimes you're kind of continuing to work with the same problems that you've created for yourself on as far as a particular detail on the figure goes.
Yeah, you're stuck on the local hill when what you really need to do is go all the way down and find a different hill.
Yeah, probably like get a new figure and just a new copy of the same figure and begin again. Yeah.
Yeah. Now, some ways around this in computer science can involve algorithms that insert various kinds of random leaps or random steps in sampling to make sure that you're actually moving toward the global solution rather than the local solution. And in a way, I think this is sort of the algorithmic way of characterizing what we would call outside the box thinking, you know, thinking that lands on strategies that may take you pretty far away from the local peak in order to possibly find out that there is a much higher peak somewhere else. And a certain amount of randomness or willingness to be apparently counterproductive, at least for the moment, can go a long way. And this is clearly what's been found, like, in these studies using the hobbits and orcs problem, because it's like people really get stuck at the part that they have the hardest time figuring out is the part where you have to move multiple pieces away from your end state in order to actually get there. Coincidentally, I think the dangers represented by the hill climbing heuristic are actually played out in literal topography in The Hobbit and Lord of the Rings. For example, I recall in Fellowship of the Ring, there's a lot of frustration about the straightest paths to Mordor being blocked, such as when they try to go across the Redhorn Pass of Caradhras, and they're blocked by bad weather, forcing them to backtrack and go a different way, even though, you know, they probably should have backtracked earlier, but they're stuck trying to go this way because it's where they already are. And I can't recall another specific passage, but it seems like there are similar problems in the Two Towers, you know, like Frodo and Sam having to go down to go up, or having to go back to go forward, and so forth.
Oh, yeah, I'm remembering that now.
So anyway, keep the hobbits and orcs in mind. If you're stuck on a problem, consider, are you hill climbing? Are you refusing to send your hobbit and orc back across the river, even though that's what you have to do?
Yeah, that's interesting. I don't think I'd heard of this before. But now now I guess I'll think of all problems in my life as being ones where orcs might potentially eat me.
Or one where you're the orc and you're going to fill up on hobbit and ruin your dinner.
Yeah, you don't want to do that. All right. Well, we're going to go ahead and call this this episode here. Obviously, we didn't get to get into everything about orcs within Tolkien's creations or within creations that have come in the wake of The Lord of the Rings. So we would love to hear from everyone out there. If you have particular thoughts on anything here related to Tolkien scholarship, to how we use orcs in popular culture, why we're fascinated by them, what we should be doing with them, etc. We're always open to hear from everybody. We're always happy to be corrected as well. In the meantime, if you would like to listen to other episodes of Stuff to Blow Your Mind, you can find us wherever you get your podcasts and wherever that happens to be. Just rate, review, and subscribe. Those are great ways to help out the show.
Huge thanks, as always, to our excellent audio producer, Seth Nicholas Johnson. If you'd like to get in touch with us with feedback on this episode or any other, to suggest a topic for the future, or just to say hello, you can email us at contact@stufftoblowyourmind.com.
Stuff to Blow Your Mind is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
Hey guys, back at the playground again, huh?
Yep. You know what this playground could use? A wine country.
Heck yeah, and some waves so we could go surfing.
Oh, yeah. Ah, love that.
A redwood forest would be cool.
I'm in.
Ah, ski slopes.
Let's do it.
Tenor girl go shopping.
Yeah, baby.
Wait. Did we just invent California?
Discover why California is the ultimate playground at visitcalifornia.com.
You don't have to hop a plane to see the world. This month's Free This Week picks on Xfinity brings you around the globe. Experience life at a European resort in the hit comedic drama Seaside Hotel from Walter Presents. Watch romance blossom abroad in a Scottish love scheme from Hallmark Movies Channel. Celebrate Earth Month with planet-saving docuseries like EcoEye with Duncan Stewart on Magellan TV. And be transported to your happy place with iHeartRadio's Feeling Good playlist. Just say Free This Week into your Xfinity voice remote.
You're a growing business, which means you need every spare hour you can find. That's why the most successful growing businesses are working together in Slack. Slack is where work happens, with all your people, data, and information in one AI-powered place. Start a call instantly in huddles and ditch cumbersome calendar invites. Or build an automation with Workflow Builder to take routine tasks off your plate. No coding required. Grow your business in Slack. Visit slack.com to get started.
Managing your diabetes just got easier. The powerful new Dexcom G7 lets you see your glucose numbers on your compatible watch and phone without fingersticks. And because Dexcom G7 is the most accurate CGM system, you can be confident in your food, exercise, and medication decisions. And all those decisions can lead to big results, like more time in range and lower A1C. Get started at Dexcom.com.
Dexcom data on file 2023. If your glucose alerts and readings from the G7 do not match symptoms or expectations, use a blood glucose meter to make diabetes treatment decisions. For a list of compatible devices, visit Dexcom.com/compatibility.